I want to talk about a peculiar topic, which is how a cosmic string loop moves and curves space-time. And in some sense, I feel a little bit sheepish working on this because we don't know if cosmic strings exist. But on the other hand, I feel quite bullish working on this because I think it's of interest to fundamental theoretical physics. You know, once, for example, Kerr solution was obtained, it was of considerable interest to understand geodesics, particle geodesics in Kerr spacetime. And this was done famously, of course, by Carter, who understood, classified all the possible particle orbits in Kerr spacetime. And it was also the mental experiments with particles and photons were of considerable interest in figuring out the structure, the important topological features of Kerr spacetime. Even though you could say particles don't really exist, well, ideal particles don't really exist. Anyway, so I think, enlarging the class of objects that move, well-defined mathematical objects, how they move on Kerr metric, I think is of some interest. So strings, in a sense, is a step up from a particle. So a particle, of course, moving in space-time on a geodesic minimizes interval. Interval in some sense is action for particle motion. A string moving in curved spacetime minimizes area which it sweeps in curved spacetime. And this is known, so this area is action, and this action is called Nambu-Goto action, which is a common, a commonly known action for strings. So it's very, you describe these objects in very simple geometric language, and I think it's of considerable interest theoretically to understand how these objects move. So from the point of view of astrophysics, I am going to, because I am an astrophysicist, I'm going to frame this problem in astrophysical language, in the language of a particular scenario that I will describe to you. And the scenario I have in mind is that I have a spinning black hole, which is sitting, for example, at the center of a galaxy. And then I have a cosmic string loop, which has a size which is much greater than the size of the black hole. This cosmic string loop flies towards the black hole, moving in some way. And part of it gets captured by the black hole here. Okay. So this is all well understood. Then the new thing that I'm going to show you is that in this configuration, if the black hole is spinning, you develop a super radiant instability, which means that the particular short wavelength tension mode living on this loop gets amplified exponentially, tapping into the spin energy of the black hole. Okay, so this is so far pretty solid. Then there is a speculative step. The speculative step is that once you take into account the reconnections of a real cosmic string, and perhaps this would produce fragments which would fly away, and each of these fragments, fragment loops, is an emitter of gravitational waves. So in some sense, you convert the spin energy of the black hole into the gravitational wave energy as executed by this agent looplets flying away from the central black hole. Okay, so this is a speculation. This last step is a speculation because in order to prove or disprove it, you need to do numerical simulations that we haven't done. Okay, and before I go to the next slide, I want to mention my great collaborators who have agreed to go with me on this useless but interesting journey. So this is Hengwei Xing, who at the time, who is a lead author actually, and who was an undergraduate, great undergraduate student at Columbia University, and two great physicists, Andrei Gruzinov, professor at NYU, and Alex Virenkin, a very famous cosmologist at Tufts. And all of these people contributed greatly to this work. So it's, it was a very intense and dynamic collaboration. Now, I'm going to give you a brief spiel about strings, because I wasn't cosmic strings. I wasn't sure how many people were familiar with this. So the physical implement, so mathematically, as far as I'm concerned, a cosmic string is, like I said, something which observes non-Bugotto action. But physically, the way they form is also, of course, of considerable interest by this famous Kibo mechanism. So what I want you to picture is some Higgs type of potential. So you have a scalar field. A scalar field in this particular example is complex valued. There is a potential on the complex plane, which has this Mexican head shape. This potential has a minimum, but this minimum is not a point, it's actually a circle. Okay, so this is a typical Higgs potential. Now, if you, in the early universe, this vacuum is not reached. In fact, the free energy of the field is minimized at this point, which is where the field equals zero. However, as the universe cools, then the field can explore its potential, and there is a phase transition when the field makes a transition from the central point to the actual vacuum. Now, of course, because there is a lot of choice where the field can make a transition, it can make a transition to different parts of the circle. So you can imagine a situation where you have a large loop in physical space, and then the field makes a transition to a vacuum at all points of this loop. But as you're going around this loop, right, there is a map between points on this loop in physical space and the points, the vacuum points in this circle. And it may well be that as you're going around this loop, you're making a finite number of non-zero number of windings around this circle, so you create this non-trivial topology. Okay, it turns out that the way the system typically deals with this is that it likes to go to a vacuum state everywhere else, but of course, if you now begin to shrink this loop, then the vacuum has to be, you know, topology is continuous, so the vacuum has to be somewhere broken. And the way the field energetically resolves it is that the vacuum is broken in very, very small regions of space, which have this one-dimensional cosmic strings, right? So everywhere outside the string, the field is in vacuum. And inside the string, the field climbs towards this potential maximum. So it's a very high energy concentration inside the strings. But as I said, so this is the how they internally made. But from macroscopic point of view, the strings really observe non-Bugotto action, and they minimize area in space-time, and that's how they move. A few kind of cheerleading statements for the dynamics of strings. They are fundamental relativistic objects, even though the way I described how they're made, they you know, you don't make them in a trivial way, but kinematically they're fundamental relativistic objects. I already said that they minimize area in space-time. Another feature of the strings is that the tension along the string equals to their mass density. And of course, since I imagine most people relativists, you're completely familiar with geometric units. In this unit, the speed of light is one. Now, tension, by definition, has units of energy divided by length. But both energy and length in geometric units are the same, have the same units. So that means that the tension of the string is dimensionless quantity in geometric units. So it's dimensionless, and it's also much smaller than one for realistic cosmic strings, right? So if, typically in cosmology literature, this tension is referred to as G times mu. I don't really like this G in geometric units, it's one. So I'm thinking of this mu. Observation in this mu is constrained to be somewhere less than 10 to the minus 11. This, I don't know why I have 10 to the minus 6. This is from old CMB data, but now with particle, sorry, with pulsar timing arrays, we know that this mu is less than about 10 to the minus 11. But there is a whole range of allowed values of mu, you know, 10 to the minus 11 is the upper end, and it can go all the way to something 10 to the minus 32. So this is, there is a huge parameter space of allowed string tensions, which is allowed in modern cosmology. The another geometric, nice geometric aspect of strings is that if you have a straight string, the space-time is very simple. So it's quite normal, except for if you take a section perpendicular to the string, then this section is missing a piece. So this the metric on this plane, which is perpendicular to the string, is that of a cone. And the deficit angle is related to the tension by 8 pi. So deficit angle is basically tension multiplied by 8 pi. So it's pretty cool. Another feature, okay, so I'm almost done with describing what the strings are, but another important feature is that real cosmic strings, they do reconnect. That means that on top of this gauge, on top of the scalar field, you also have gauge field, which is confined inside the local cosmic string. So this gauge field, this magnetic type field, which I'm showing here by this arrow, when the string self-intersects, so intersects with another string, it reconnects. Reconnection, just like in the case of magnetic reconnection, basically happens because this minimizes free energy. And it reconnects in such a way that you can continuously continue this error. So this magnetic field type thing, you know, continues along the line here. So this is how this reconnection happens. If you take a string loop and go into its center of mass frame of reference, the string loop, it turns out, moves periodically, and the period is basically the length of the string. And I'm putting C here because, well, I shouldn't really, because I told you it's geometric units, but so the period is basically the length of a string loop. This particular length is called the invariant length. And the final, I guess, factoid about strings is that I have given you a very simple description of what strings do, how they behave. And you can solve a well-posed problem. So suppose you have an expanding universe and you have a string network in this expanding universe, what will happen to the string network? And it's quite well understood for a long time that the network settles into a self-similar solution where in every Hubble volume, you have several long strings which are piercing this Hubble volume, plus a variety of string loops which have formed as a result of this reconnection. Now, people are still arguing, you know, that there's a variety of prescriptions of what is the distribution of sizes of the string loops. And of course, this is very important for cosmology because distribution of sizes of the string loops determines the spectrum of gravitational waves that these loops emit. And gravitational waves is one of the primary ways of looking for cosmic strings. So, okay, I think I've given you enough of a background now about this paper that we have written. So I want you to think about a black hole. So this is the black hole. And I want you to take a piece of string and to drop the other end of a string onto the black hole. Now, it's pretty clear that, you know, there will be some oscillations, blah, 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 but ultimately the system will settle into equilibrium. And here, by the way, the black hole is not rotating. And the equilibrium would be very simple, that you're holding a string at one end and it radially drops into a black hole at the other end. So this is a stationary solution for this system, okay? So now what I want to do is I want you to, so this is like your fishing line into a black hole. Now I want you to consider a slow motion. So I take this piece of string and I slowly move it around like I show here on the diagram. And of course, if the motion is slow, then the string will adiabatically adjust in such a way that basically pivots around the center of black hole in such a way, always remaining radial for sufficiently slow motion of the string end. Okay, now this mental picture helps to visualize the simple idea that in some sense, black hole is just a pivot point for a string. You know, for motions which are slow enough compared to light crossing of, you know, from the black hole to this point where I'm holding the string, for motions which are slow enough, this black hole is just a pivot. So I now want to use this mental picture and consider the situation where I have a long string loop, long but light, which is pivoted at some point around the black hole. So here it is. So I have this black hole, I have a long string loop. What I'm going to do now, for now, I will return to this point and in depth look at this a little later. But for now, what I want to do is I want to replace this black hole by a simple fixed point in space, right? So I take this point, this region, and I nail it to some fixed point in space, and I let the rest of the cosmic string loop to move freely. So, and obviously this is a valid approximation where I have the length of the loop, which is much greater than the radius of the black hole, and where the loop is smooth enough that there are no kinks which happen on the scale comparable to the size of the black hole. Now, it turns out that the motion of the spinned loop is periodic, and now the period is twice the length of the spinned loop. Remember, for a free loop, it was just the length. And the length is defined, the invariant length is just the mass of the loop divided by the tension. So it has a simple definition. Okay, so I want to look at the motion of the spinned loop in a little bit more detail. So I have this invariant length of the loop, and I want to introduce a coordinate sigma, which marks the invariant length along the loop as I go from one end to another. And so the motion of the loop, which is this vectorial r, r is a function of the sigma, which is the coordinate invariant length coordinate along the string and time. And it turns out that it observes a very simple, you know, this vectorial function observes a very simple wave equation, which is written here, and c is 1, otherwise there would have been c squared here on the left-hand side. And the pinning just means that there is a boundary condition, right? That r of 0 t equals r of l of t equals 0. Okay, this is the pinning. Now, it turns out that in writing this wave equation, I have chosen some particular gauge. And this gauge constraints are stated here, that dr dt is, this is the velocity of a string, is perpendicular to its tangent vector dr d sigma. And the sum of their squares is 1. And these gauge conditions are completely respected by this wave equation. So if you start off with this constraint being satisfied and you allow this wave equation to proceed, then these constraints will continue to be satisfied. Okay, so the key idea for the rest of the talk is that, and this is like really important, so far it's just background, but the key idea is that the motion of pinned loop is specified by some fixed three-dimensional curve, auxiliary curve in three-dimensional space. So let me go through this briefly, but this is, you know, mathematically an important point. So remember, I have this wave equation. So r of sigma and t observes wave equations. So in principle, wave equations, as we all know, the solution to the wave equation is given by the left going wave and the right going wave. So if A and B are here vectorial functions. Now, because of the gauge conditions, it turns out that A and B satisfy the fact that the dA, d sigma, and dB, d sigma have unit length. I forgot to write it down here. But the gauge conditions that I specified in the previous page mean that both A and B have unit tangent vectors. Okay, that's that turns out to be equivalent. Now, the pinning introduces boundary conditions, and the boundary conditions look like this. So A is just like related to B through this reflection symmetry. And it turns out that the second boundary condition implies that A is doubly periodic with a period of 2L, not L, but 2L. So if you then define A and B on the whole real axis, then the part between zero and L corresponds to a moving pinned loop, okay? So the general solution for pinned loop is given by this expression. Because of this relationship between A and B, everything is expressed through A. So R of sigma and T equals 1/2 of A of sigma minus T minus A of minus sigma minus T. Okay, where A is a doubly periodic function. It's a vectorial function, which means that A makes a loop in three-dimensional space as you go from 0 to 2L. And also, A has a unit tangent vector, okay, due to gauge conditions. That means that basically sigma is just the length measured along this loop, okay? So you have this auxiliary loop that A is making. And now this R of sigma and T, it has the meaning of a chord in this loop, right? So if you choose a point on this loop, which is a negative T, you go negative T plus sigma, and you go negative T minus sigma, okay? This is the chord which is connecting these two things. From here to here is twice R. So R is half of this chord. And in this language, it's very easy to visualize what reconnection is in this loop, right? Reconnection means that the position of the loop is the same for two different coordinates at the same time. That means that there exist two identical chords on this loop, okay, which are equal to each other. And what reconnection means is that you find these chords and you take these middle segments, which are connecting these chords, and you throw them away, and then you glue the rest along these identical chords. And then the rest is the auxiliary curve for the loop, which remains pinned to the black hole. And so one of the theorems that you can immediately prove is that there is, you can find examples of trajectories of this pinned loops, which are non-self-intersecting. So, and a particular theorem that we proved is that we're considering these auxiliary curves to be quadrilaterals, spatial quadrilaterals in space. Then unless the special conditions on, you know, very special condition on the length of the sides of this quadrilateral is satisfied, you don't have self-intersecting trajectories. You can't find these pairs of parallel chords. And so this means that generic quadrilaterals, if you take auxiliary curve, which is a generic quadrilateral, spatial quadrilateral, it corresponds to a loop which is non-self-intersecting. Okay, so this gave us some hope that it was quite possible to find trajectories which are non-self-intersecting for pinned loops. And this was confirmed by our numerical experiments, which I'm going to show you now. So you, in this numerical experiments, you take a generic shape pinned loop and you see what happens to it as it evolves. And as you see that as it evolves, it self-intersects, it pinches off different parts, these parts fly off, But after several self-intersections, so this is the second, there will be one more self-intersection. After several self-intersections, it settles into stable configuration, which is not self-intersecting, okay? So this means that the loop, which is the string loop, which is captured by a black hole, doesn't completely self-destroy by self-intersections, but instead after several self-intersections, it settles into some, you know, stable configuration. So the question now is, once you have this loop, which is stably moving around the black hole, what happens to that remnant? Okay, so this is what the rest of my talk is about. I threw off this transient self-intersecting bits of the loop, and now I want to know what happens to the rest of the loop, you know, on longer time scale, not just on the time scale of.
Sorry, can I ask, is the assumption that the loop mass is infinite compared to the black hole mass?
The assumption is that the black hole mass is infinite compared to the loop mass. So the loop is massless here.
Loop is massless. Okay.
As you can see, so let me play this movie again. You see the loop is pinned here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a black hole.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Where my cursor is a black hole. It's all those fragments, you know, that just fly off. And then you're left with a loop which is pinned to the black hole. So the question is, what happens to this bit which is pinned?
Sorry, may I ask some questions? So what stops this loop from falling into the black hole? Is it because of angular momentum or?
Yeah, it's angular momentum, right?
Okay.
But as I will explain shortly, the black hole does have a way of consuming this loop. And in fact, if black hole is not spinning, then the loop will eventually be depleted and absorbed by the black hole in a fairly interesting way. On the other hand, if black hole is spinning, then the loop doesn't generally get absorbed by the black hole. And in fact, you can use the black hole's energy to grow the length of the loop. And this is why we call the spinning black holes as string factories, because you can use the spin of the black hole to pump the length of the loop which is attached to it.
Also, I got a bit confused. How did the black hole, aside from pinning the loop, enter the equation? Was that the only place that?
So far, yes. Any more questions? Okay. So now let's talk about, let's move away from just thinking of a black hole as a site of pinning. And let's consider what happens really due to interaction of the string with black hole horizon. And so it turns out that this problem was studied already by many people, notable Canadians like Frolov and his group and some others.
Actually, Yuri, could I ask one quick question before you go on? I just tried to do a back of the envelope calculation after Neil's question about the string being massless compared to the black hole, and I got something like if it has sort of 10 to the minus 11 near the upper bound tension, that if it was more than about 100 AU long, that it would be sort of comparable to a solar mass. Does that sound right?
Yeah, probably.
Is the idea that the whole string is shorter than that? Is the idea that the whole string has to be less massive than the black hole? Or is the only thing that matters somehow is the string within some certain dynamical vicinity of the black hole?
The idea is that the whole string loop which is interacting with the black hole has to be smaller than the black hole.
For it to be strictly fixed, yes. I guess probably even if it was bigger, though, but it was on too long a length scale, then the black hole would be so slow that probably everything you're doing is Still a good approximation.
Sorry, this I don't understand. If the black hole mass is comparable to the mass of the loop, then of course the black hole becomes a relativistic object that moves relativistically together with the loop. It becomes very complicated.
Okay, yeah.
But for example, for a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy, which I think really has a chance of capturing string loops, the loop has to be very large in order to be able to move the black hole. Let's put it this way. But actually, this is one of the things that I'll come back to as well, is when you relax the assumption of the infinite mass of a black hole. This is one of the things that we do consider in the paper.
Okay, thank you.
But for now, I want to fix... for now, I want to study the massless case, okay? The case of massless, massless string loop and infinitely massive black hole, if you like. So a string, for now, is a test. It's a test string. Okay. So it turns out that you can think of a black hole in a way, within some kind of a membrane paradigm. You can think of a black hole as some kind of rotating viscous sphere, if you like. And if you're dropping a straight string into the black hole, the string does acquire some, near the black hole, even though asymptotically the string is straight, near the black hole, it does acquire some crazy spiral configuration, which results in angular momentum exchange between the string and the black hole. And so the form of the torque between the string and the black hole, this is the form, is that this vector n hat multiplied by omega. Omega is the angular velocity vector of the black hole, cross product with n. So this is the form of the torque. It turns out that if you take a string like this and drop it into a black hole, and this string is infinite, then the angular momentum you extract from the black hole will drive the spin of the black hole into alignment with the string, right? So this angular momentum vector omega, it will be projected, over time, it will be projected onto this completely straight and fixed string. And eventually you will have a configuration where black hole spin vector is pointing in this direction, right? I hope you can all see my cursor moving. All right, so this is what will happen if you just drop a straight infinite string into a spinning black hole. You will drive this alignment. One other element which is related to the question that was asked before is that if the black hole is not spinning and you take this straight string, okay, and you begin to move it around, I told you that if you move it adiabatically, then the string will remain nearly radial, keep dropping into the horizon along the nearly radial line. However, there is a friction term, right? Because you're never perfectly adiabatic. So if you're moving around with finite velocity, there is a friction term. And this friction term, again, results in angular momentum exchange between the string and the black hole. And this is given, again, by this vector n cross-producted into the angular velocity of this vector n, okay? This is just a fancy way of saying that if you are moving around the string, let's say here in the clockwise direction, it will gradually spin up the black hole in the same direction as well. So this is the horizon friction. Okay, so you have these two effects: torque from the black hole spin, and the horizon friction from the motion of the string itself. Right. So this is related to the motion of the black hole relative to the fixed string. This is related to the motion of a fixed string, motion of the string relative to the fixed black hole. Of course, in real situations, you have to take both of this into account. Then the third effect was what Latham mentioned If you just consider the combined action of these two torques, you get this expression. This is just to show you that the coefficients, you know, I wrote here proportionality coefficients. These proportionality coefficients are not horrible. It's just 4 times tension mu times r squared, where r is the radius of the black hole. And the rest of it, this is just another way of writing this expression, and this is this term here. So this is quite a straightforward addition of these two things. And of course, what you get is that if the black hole is spinning with the same angular velocity as you're moving the string, and this torque is zero. Okay, so if the string bit is co-rotating, if you like, with the black hole, and there is no angular momentum exchange. Okay, then the third effect, which is what Nathan mentioned, is that there is a recoil. If the black hole has finite mass, then it's no longer, even if black hole mass is still substantially greater than the loop mass, and the string motion is not strictly periodic. It's only strictly periodic if the black hole is completely still in place. If you allow black hole to move, then the orbit changes on a time scale of the period of the orbit multiplied by the mass ratio of the mass of the black hole to the mass of the loop. So even though this can be quite a large number compared to unity, but multiplied by the period of the string, this is still small compared to typical evolutionary timescales that are of astrophysical interest. So this effect is important. And so the key idea is that all three of these effects, they cause the evolution of the auxiliary curve. Remember, I said that for a perfectly pinned loop, the auxiliary curve is completely fixed in space. But introducing all of these three effects, it makes this auxiliary curve move in space, right? So in a way, a useful comparison to think about is that if you have a perfectly Keplerian orbit of a planet around the star, for example, this planet is moving on a fixed ellipse, a fixed elliptical orbit, right? So even though the position of a planet changes, the position of its orbital ellipse is fixed in space. This is an invariant of Keplerian motion, you know, the position of Keplerian ellipse. It's the same, it's very similar for this loop pinned to a black hole. For perfectly pinned loop, its auxiliary curve is stationary, it's invariant. Even though the loop itself moves, the auxiliary curve is invariant and stationary in space. Now, in the planetary dynamics problem, if you introduce some gravitational perturbation, for example, you know, if you introduce another correction to Keplerian potential or some other distant planet, okay, what this perturbation will do is that it will make the orbital ellipse evolve. So the orbital ellipse is no longer stationary, but both its shape and its orientation will be evolving. This is the so-called secular perturbation theory for Keplerian dynamics. Exactly the same here. If you introduce perturbations due to this torque that I described, the torque between the spinning black hole and the moving loop, and also due to the black hole recoil, in the limit where all of these three things are small compared to, you know, they have timescales which are slow compared to dynamical timescale of the loop. You can think of this as a slow evolution of this auxiliary curve, right? So this is how I map the evolution. You know, instead of considering crazy dynamics of the loop all the time, I just consider nice and smooth and slow dynamics of the auxiliary curve. And it turns out that this dynamics is very nice mathematically.
Yeah, so, may I ask one question? Sorry for interrupting. So do these effects, do they take into account the long-range gravitational field of black hole already? I mean, just normal Newtonian potential from the black hole. Because before it was not there, right? When you consider this auxiliary curve, that was just motion of string in flat space-time.
Right.
So now, okay, there are these three effects, yes, but there is also gravitational field of black hole, right? Just Newtonian gravitational potential. So how does that affect the string?
That's a very good question. And here it's not explicitly taken into account. Maybe you're right and it should be considered.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Right, because since I'm considering weak effects, right? I mean, clearly this is a weak effect, but since I'm considering weak effects, maybe it does enter into some order, right? So this is a very good remark. Okay, so modulo this potential correction. So let's just consider the effect of these three things, and then we can perhaps discuss of how to take into account this other Newtonian potential of the black hole. Now it turns out that horizon friction just leads to the curve shortening. So this is auxiliary curve. It turns out that what the dynamics of this curve due to the horizon friction is that you imagine that this auxiliary curve has some elasticity and you put it in honey. So there is some viscous force which is counteracting this tension. So it evolves viscously under the action of its elasticity. So this means that the velocity of this auxiliary curve is proportional to this curvature vector, d squared a, d sigma squared. It turns out that this motion has already, you know, it has a name. It's called curve shortening evolution. It has been extensively studied by mathematicians like Richard Hamilton and others. But physically, it's quite clear what will happen is that this auxiliary curve, even though it may have like sharp turns and whatever, but after a while, asymptotically, it turns into a shrinking circle. And the shrinking circle, it disappears after a finite time. The finite time turns out to be given by a very simple expression. So this is the original length of the curve, right? Divided by the square of the size of the black hole. So after this finite time, you know, coming back to the question which was asked before, the loop is actually swallowed by the black hole. So this is the time scale in which the loop disappears, but it takes some time. So if you have long loop, that will take some time for it to be swallowed. And now in the final stages of the swallowing, being swallowed by the black hole, the auxiliary curve is given by a circle. This means, this is just saying the same thing. So here you have some general shape auxiliary curve. It gradually turns into this shrinking circle. This means this corresponds to a general shape moving loop around the black hole, turning into this very particular shape, which is a double line. You know, it asymptotically turns into a double line. So this is, it exits the black hole, it goes along some interval, turns around, goes back into the black hole. And so this whole configuration is rotating around the black hole like a whip, and its tip is moving with the speed of light. So this is like a cusp of a string, except for this cusp is continuous. It's a gravitational, it's an ultra-relativistic whip, which is rotating around this black hole with the tip moving at the speed of light. And of course, this means that there is a copious amount of gravitational waves which are continuously emitted in the direction of the motion of this whip. So there is this very strong, gravitational wave synchrotron emission from this, from this rotating configuration.
Yuri, does this mean that the length is out to the light cylinder of the rotating black hole for some reason?
No, there is this black hole was not rotating. Remember, this is still, let me get back. This is horizon friction, right?
Oh, okay.
So this is just, so this literally means that you take this initial configuration, you give, you give some general initial condition to this loop. This loop will evolve, it will shrink, but it will shrink configuration to a configuration which is rotating in this crazy way. So as it's rotating in this crazy way, of course, it will shrink. You know, this whip keeps shrinking in length because of the horizon friction. And also, which is not explicitly taken into account because of this gravitational wave emission. But the black hole is not spinning here. There's no light cylinder. Now the torque, if you talk about the effect of the torque of the black hole on the spin loop, remember this corresponds to, so I'm talking now about the motion of this loop. This is the velocity vector. And this corresponds to the velocity vector of the loop being kind of in the direction of, if you like, a Lorentz force, where the role of magnetic field is played by the spin vector of the black hole, and this is the tangent vector to the auxiliary loops, right? So you take the cross product of this tangent vector and the spin of the black hole. So it turns out that it typically leads to loop lengthening, right? It typically leads to lengthening of the auxiliary loop, okay? And moreover, it amplifies short wavelength helical wiggles, as I'll explain in a second. So this is the result of the so-called superradians. And the conjecture is that the superradians leads to black hole bombs. Let me explain the superradians. The superradians, okay, right. So consider now a black hole which is spinning in this direction. And consider a helical wave which comes towards the black hole, and its helicity is aligned with the spin of the black hole. So it's helically rotating in the same direction as the black hole. It turns out that upon reflection from the black hole, the amplitude of this helical wave will be amplified. And this was understood, this effect was understood by Zeldovich in 1971 and worked out by many other people in other contexts. Zeldovich didn't understand that for strings. He wasn't thinking about strings. He was thinking about general modes of some field. But it was understood by him that if the rotation of the black hole exceeds rotation of the mode, then upon reflection, the mode should be amplified. Now, as the wave is amplified, if this was an infinite string, it would just travel out and never interact with the black hole again. But because it's a loop, this wave is now traveling in the opposite direction, but as it's traveling in the opposite direction, the loop is evolving. So by the time that the wave is reaching the opposite end of the string loop and interacting with the loop again, the loop has reoriented itself in such a way that the wave is propagating along this original direction, okay? So just at the moment this pulse is interacting with the black hole, it's moving along its original direction. This is just how it turns out to be. And its helicity is in the same sense. So upon reflection, it gets amplified again. So this pulse is repeatedly bouncing back and forth between these two configurations. And upon reflection, it gets amplified. So this leads to a very, very quick amplification of the helical wave, which is living on this loop. This is, of course, in real space. I've given you the real space description of what happens. And that's quite a fast growth rate. Now, in terms of the language of auxiliary curve, remember, I like to also think about, this is kind of in the language of real loop, real tension waves. But in terms of the language of the auxiliary curve, because you have this kind of Lorentz force which is acting on this auxiliary curve, if you introduce a little wiggle on the auxiliary curve, this superadding instability corresponds to the steady growth of this wiggle, right? So if you take this little helical configuration on the auxiliary curve, which is aligned with the spin of the black hole, then this helical configuration will grow, okay? And so this little coils will enhance in size. And you can see by looking at this picture that for generic configurations, this growth leads to self-intersection of auxiliary curve, right? If auxiliary curve started off being non-self-intersecting, and after a while, it will begin intersecting itself. You can show that intersections of auxiliary curve correspond to splitting of this loop, which is attached to the black hole, into several loops, right? It corresponds, you know, every time auxiliary curve intersects, this corresponds to part of the loop being captured by the black hole, you know, an extra part of this loop being captured by the black hole. So this loop, which is originally captured by the black hole, you know, fragments, and you have several sections of this loop which are attached to this black hole. So the question that you might ask is, what happens to each of these, you know, to each of the simple sections which gets attached to a black hole? And it turns out that you can prove that, again, each of the section which corresponds to, you know, each of them has their own little auxiliary curve. This auxiliary curve again turn into a circle. So this means that if you're starting off with some generic configuration of the loop which is captured by the black hole, this loop will evolve, it will fragment, you know, it will fragment in the sense that parts of it will get captured by the black hole, and each of the simple parts will turn into this ultra-relativistic whip, which is co-rotating with the black hole. But now, except the difference with the previous one, where it just had cries and frictions, that each of this whip will grow in size. And okay, you can say this is all very nice, but you haven't really talked about what happens when you include self-intersections of this string loop, because self-intersections, as I told you, leads to reconnection. And indeed, this is one big uncertainty of our model, is that we don't have a numerical model of what self-intersections will do. So this is the big uncertainty about the nonlinear development of this system. Now, one thing that you can prove analytically, though, is that you can have this double line features, right, which are nearly double line and asymptotically non-self-intersecting. So you can find configurations which will exist forever, always expanding, always having this crazy ultra-relativistic velocities of the tip, but nonetheless will never self-intersect. Okay, so this is an analytical result which is in our paper. How common it is to reach these configurations, we don't know, you know, because we haven't solved the problem of self-intersections. Okay, so I'm close to the end of my time, I think, right? But I just want to say that this is open question. Role of reconnection is not clear. Whether there are asymptotics, whether there are limit cycles, whether what is the size of ejected loop, whether reconnection leads to ejection of loops, etc. This is all not clear. Now, just a few, I'll take another 2 minutes to talk about the real world. In real world, as I said, there is a big range of allowed tensions which are allowed by observations from 10 to the minus 32. 10 to the minus 11. And it is understood by Chernoff first, and then in much better analysis by Jane and Belenkin, is that if these small loops have small tension, then due to the expansion of the universe, these loops which form in the early universe get slowed down by the Hubble friction to small velocities. Small tension helps because then you don't have gravitational wave rocket effect, which would accelerate these loops. These slowed down loops then get captured together with dark matter when the galaxies form and dark matter collapses into galaxies. The same happens to these loops. These loops go into galactic halos and get captured by galactic halos. And so because growing black holes tend to adiabatically concentrate density around themselves, these loops tend to be adiabatically captured in orbits which are close to supermassive black holes. And the captures are quite likely for sufficiently small mu's, the captures by a supermassive black hole of one of these loops, okay? So if the loop survives after it gets captured onto supermassive black hole, it can tap the spin energy of the black hole. Why is this important? Well, it's because if you look at the energy of black hole spins and divided by the energy of the universe, you know, sufficient to close the universe, you get quite a large number, which is 10 to the minus 7, multiplied by dimensionless spins of these black holes. This is a very large number. And let me remind you that LISA, and I'm saying LISA because LISA has characteristic frequencies which correspond to horizon sizes of supermassive black holes. LISA will detect stochastic background where the energy of gravitational waves only 10 to the minus 13 and a half that of the energy of the universe, right? So there's a huge range of scales here. You know, even if you manage to tap a small fraction of the black hole spin energy into this cosmic string loops and then into gravitational waves, then this could potentially be a very interesting signal for LISA. Another signature of this process would be that the black holes get spun down on this time scale. The time scale is very simple. It's just the radius of the black hole divided by the dimensionless tension. You can make an estimate of the black hole of 10 to the 8 solar masses, the tension of 10 to the minus 15. This is smaller than the Hubble time. So this spin down should result in non-accreting black holes to be spun down to very small spins. Okay, so takeaway messages, let me conclude. I'm sorry for running over time. There is nice geometry in physics. There is 1D geometric flows, blah, blah, blah. Super radians, ultra-realistic whips. As Sergei pointed out, perhaps we don't understand everything about this physics. Perhaps there are some other subtle effects that we haven't thought about. So it's it's an interesting problem. The way to justify thinking about these problems on top of the cuteness is that in principle, the fact that we are now searching for gravitational wave signatures from this type of things, could somehow justify doing this work. And there is a lot of stuff that still needs to be understood, and in particular, reconnections, but also perhaps other pieces of physics that we haven't thought about. So that's it.
Okay, great. So thanks, Yuri. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for a great talk. Okay, so we've had a bunch of questions. Are there any further questions for Yuri?
I had one. Maybe you could, I have a feeling I'm confused about something, but I just wanted, if I understood correctly, you were saying that if a helicity, let's say a right-handed helicity wave comes along the string and hits the black hole and sort of bounces off with Dirichlet boundary conditions, that it stays a right-handed helicity wave, but I think I would have thought it would become a left-handed helicity wave when it bounced off, just because my intuition is just that the angular direction of sort of angular rotation stays the same, but the momentum switches when the occurs.
No, that's completely correct. It becomes, it's a right-handed helicity when it goes in this direction, uh-huh. Bounces off, it becomes left-handed, right? So it rotates in the same direction, though, right?
And so then what, and so I, okay, so, then so, I misunderstand. So the amplification happens despite the fact that it keeps switching helicity from time, from bounce to bounce.
Yeah, it keeps switching helicity from bounce to bounce, but the key thing is that it keeps its sense of rotation. So if it rotates in this direction, right, in the same direction as the black hole,
yeah,
by the time it propagates around, okay, the loop has moved, but the sense of rotation is still the same. Right,
uh-huh.
Angular momentum is conserved. So by the time it comes around from the other side, it is rotating again in the same sense as the black hole.
Oh, I see. So the additional point is that the two places where it's intersecting the black hole, one is, let's say, in the North Pole, and the other is in the South.
That's right. It switches the poles. It goes from north to south to north to south.
Uh huh. But what? Okay. I think I was somehow thinking from this, combining this with. So I shouldn't combine this with the whip picture. If it's simultaneously doing the whip thing where the two feet are at...
No, the whip is separate from this. This is just the initial stages, right? You take the smooth loop.
Okay.
And you think what's going to happen to the smooth loop.
Okay.
And you show that there is this exponential growth, right? Initial exponential growth. But then you ask a question, how do you think about the nonlinear phase of this exponential growth,
mm-hmm.
right? If you think about nonlinear phase of this exponential growth, it is better to go into this picture of auxiliary curve, right? Where this auxiliary curve, you know, is moving slowly. If it was originally smooth, but you introduced a little wiggle here, and this wiggle initially grows exponentially, but once the amplitude of this wiggle becomes large, then the growth turns algebraic. And so it grows algebraically, but still on quite a short time scale. So then you can imagine that these wiggles begin to intersect each other, just like what was drawn here. When they intersect each other, you can show that self-intersections of auxiliary curve correspond to fragmentations of physical loop in this way. And then after it cannot fragment anymore, right, each of these fragments then turns into a whip.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Chris had a question.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
Two quick questions, actually. So one is, I cannot recall, but I vaguely remember that there was some possibility that strings could pass through each other if the velocity or orientation were... in some range of parameter space. And I don't know, is that a possibility? And secondly, what is the what's the influence of gravitational wave back reaction on the auxiliary curve?
Right. So two great questions. The first one, I didn't do my due diligence. I should have talked about this. I was too keen to get on to the actual results of our paper. But my due diligence was to say that this picture of intersections, reconnections, right? This is only true for real cosmic strings with gauge fields. And for real cosmic strings with gauge fields, the reconnection probability is very high. In some simulations, when people show that these segments collide with high velocities, sometimes in the simulations, it doesn't reconnect. But you know, even if it doesn't reconnect with 100% probability, you should think that the reconnection is extremely high. However, there is a whole other strain of thought in people who think about strings, which is that perhaps you could have fundamental strings, not cosmic strings, but fundamental superstrings, which we usually think of as microscopic objects. But perhaps there is a possibility that during early phases of the universe expansion, these microscopic objects would be amplified to macroscopic sizes, in which case they're just like, you know, normal cosmic strings, except for they don't have these gauge fields, you know, they are fundamental strings. And with fundamental strings, the reconnection probability can be tiny. And the reason is because fundamental strings can, of course, they can intersect in four-dimensional space, but because they themselves exist in higher dimensional space, you know, they themselves exist in whatever 11-dimensional space or whatever you like. In 11-dimensional space, they may not intersect, right? And so this papers by Mark Jackson and Joe Bulchinski and stuff like this, which I actually wrote down here, the reconnection probability that they find is very, very small. So in a way, yes, I think it is interesting to consider a range of possibilities where the reconnection probability could be high or the reconnection probability could be near zero. I think both of those cases are, you know, from a physical, you know, from the physics point of view, are valid and interesting. As for your second point about the radiation reaction onto the auxiliary curve from gravitational radiation, you're absolutely correct. We haven't done that. That's just a problem that awaits to be done.
Okay.
May I ask us a very quick question? So you have this lower bound on the tension. So where does it come from? I mean, terminologically, when you estimate.
10^-32?
Yeah.
Vilyankin told me. I think.
This sounds like TV scale. So yeah, if we think of this sector, if it interacts strongly with our sector, then probably yes. But it can be a weakly hidden sector, yeah, which interacts very weakly, that produces the strings, and then I think the tension can be lower.
Lower than 10^-32?
Yeah, the scale in this other sector can be low if it's a hidden sector.
Uh huh. Okay, that's very interesting. I remember. So I'm not, you know, as you understand, I'm very new to this field, so I don't know those things. But Vilyankin was saying words like God series, and so I don't know.
Because for me it sounds like something which we have direct bounds, you know, new physics scales which interact strongly with our physics, yeah, and that is this range, yeah, like TV scale. But okay, if it's another sector which we don't probe directly, I think it can be, yeah, of course the question is what's the mechanism of production, if there is a decent mechanism for production of the strings, and what will be the amount of them, but I think like pure terms of tension, it can be lower.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's very interesting. But of course, right, I mean, we have to be also reasonable. The tension is low. If the tension is that low, we'll probably never see it.
Your mechanism of amplification of gravitational wave may still be working, you know?
Right. No, that's exactly right. But the problem is, so my mechanism is very good for low tension strings, right? Yeah. Because first of all, these low tension strings are the ones that get captured in galactic nuclei. But I'm just worried that if you make the tension too low, that the strings may do fantastically interesting things, but they never radiate enough gravitational waves for this to be observed.
Yeah, this I don't know, but on the other hand, it can be, I mean, your process can be the only way actually to see this low tension string.
Yes, right. So this is another great point, is that this is how we solved it to ourselves, in some sense, as astrophysicists, is that this mechanism opens up a possibility of seeing low tension strings and gravitational waves. So typically, even if you look at optimistic Lisa curves, you know, tensions of like 10^-17 are completely unobservable, right? Even though people think Lisa will be very good for seeing, you know, cosmic string, gravitational waves from cosmic strings. But if this mechanism is efficient in some sense, then this can suddenly open up a window for those low tension, you know, low tension things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Very nice talk.
Does the string thickness, you know, depend on this tension? Like, you know, like, you know, so for like, so, you know, so for low tensions, would the thickness of this string itself become bigger than the black hole?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's really, really low tension, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. So like, okay. So 10 to the minus 32 is still fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 10 to minus 32 is really like TV scale. So
yeah, so the thickness is TV.
Yeah, thickness is TV. So I mean, this is really, I mean, microscopic. I mean, so yeah. you, there is a lot of room to lower tension astrophysics, I mean, from astrophysical viewpoint.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can I ask a question?
Okay, so last question.
the very last question. So this whole thing sounds a little bit like the magnetic flux tubes. And I'm just, if you just, I mean, do you agree or not?
With what?
Yeah. But it looks like magnetic flux tubes, these are strings or not?
Not completely, because they look like superconducting magnetic flux tubes. The reason is that normal magnetic flux tubes, for example, you can say, I mean, if I try to interpret where you're going with this, are you saying that can you apply similar logic, let's say, to normal magnetized plasma?
Yeah, I guess what I'm going with this is that, can you think of this as like a dynamo mechanism, what you kind of discovered, and then maybe where it saturates, it will be like some sort of a co-partition, but I don't know, maybe that's stretching it too much.
Yeah, magnetic fields behave very differently. Magnetic fields in astrophysically magnetized plasma, they behave very differently around black holes. And that's because magnetic field lines in plasma, they do have tension. And you know, if you have low density, the tension waves, the alpha waves, they do propagate with the speed of light. So this is similar. But they also have pressure. That means that magnetic field lines like to repel each other. And the pressure is comparable to tension, right? Mm-hmm. So if you capture a flux tube onto the black hole, what happens to this flux tube is that it will spread, you know, it will spread and turn into a split monopole, which is centered on the black hole. So it will not be confined geometrically. The real difference here is the presence of scalar fields which confine magnetic flux to a very thin, you know, thin region.
Okay. Oh, good. Thank you.
So Neil, can I ask a last question?
I actually also have one, but
okay. Actually, since Craig probably has to go, why don't we stop the recording, and then people can feel free to stick around?